Hello, everybody. Welcome to You, Me, Them, everybody. My name is Brandon Weatherby, and I am sitting in a restaurant, Instant Noodles, with
Nathan Jurgensen. Is the wrapper on the chopsticks going to be louder than your voice?
It might be. I'm holding the chopsticks. Well, I'll just do it now. I have gum in my mouth, and I don't want to do the whole thing with gum in my mouth, but there's nowhere to spit the gum, so I'm going to use the chopstick wrapper.
This is just like fresh air.
This is exactly like fresh air. I was listening to the Diane Rehm show before we met, and no matter what I do now, it will be better than the Diane Rehm show.
I love Diane Rehm.
Why? Have you been on that show?
No.
You are on NPR a decent amount, about once every month, is that right?
Right, I'm on Baltimore's
Baltimore. NPR. I like how you made it with a D.
That's how they say it in Baltimore. If you say Baltimore, it immediately outs you as an outsider.
So you're in Baltimore. You're in Baltimore once a month.
Yeah, WYPR, they have a show called Marilyn Morning with Sheila Cast. And they about once a month, they come on and talk about social media.
Why do you come on and talk about social media?
Well, I'm a PhD student studying social media, and also I write a blog.
So when you get your doctorate, what will it say?
It'll
PhD in what?
Yeah, the degree should say doctorate in philosophy or something like that. That's what all doctors say. But it'll technically be a PhD in sociology from the University of Maryland.
But it's specifically social media sociology.
I'm doing social theory. That would be
the specific.
So sociology is an incredibly big field. Sociology, the study of society, which is everything.
Okay.
And so sociologists have really, really diverse studies. And I study social theory, the theoretical components of sociology, and most of the time I point that theory towards social media.
Okay, why social media? What about it interested you?
Why
choose this for a career?
Yeah, I mean, I always, when I was going through bachelor's and even through my master's degree, I didn't want to be the person who studied the media.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in college, I was the worst paper in class. And so I was like, oh, I'm going to study the media.
Yeah.
I was always the worst paper. I didn't want to study the media. And so I decided to study knowledge. That was my specialty.
Could that be more abstract?
Probably not.
Okay.
Well, power,
yeah.
Language.
I just like the idea
time.
Of thought.
Right, truth. What we consider truth.
When you go in the cave and you see the shadow. Right. All right, so you're studying social media because you want to study thought.
Knowledge. Okay, so my master's thesis was called a conceptual analysis of anti-intellectualism and its political consequences. So I looked at the concept of anti-intellectualism in America and how that differs basically between Republicans and Democrats, the left and the right.
And what year is this? Let's give people some context.
2008, 2007, mostly 2007.
Okay, so that's a pretty good time to be studying that.
Right.
More Democrats are in the House and Senate at this point. The sweep is happening, but there's a giant divide in the country. Oh, we're at a restaurant. We should make that clear. So was it about politics at the time? Or
yeah.
Was it just about just whatever?
Well, I was in a lower-ranked college. And
yeah, where did you go for undergrad?
It was Northern Illinois University.
Yeah.
It's a big school, not a very prestigious, highly ranked
Is that where
school.
They had the shooting?
Yes.
Okay.
I was gone only a few months, but actually knew the shooter quite well.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Have you talked about this? Can you talk about this?
I can talk about it.
Well, how did you know him?
Well, I ran a quantitative research lab at Northern Illinois University.
Okay.
And
what does that mean? What is a quantitative research lab?
It was basically where you taught statistics to undergrads, like sociology-style statistics and computer programs, and how to do quantitative computer-based sociology.
Okay.
And so I taught the undergrad statistics and sociology class, and it was run in a lab, and I ran the lab, and one of our star students, one year, he aced the class, had the best grade in the class, and he was going to be a graduate student in the sociology program with me, a year behind me, and we decided to bring him in to work in the lab. And I left, I got my master's degree, came out here to Maryland, and...
You got your master's in Maryland?
Got my master's at Northern Illinois University.
Okay, you got your master's at Northern Illinois.
Right, correct.
Okay.
And I came out to Maryland in the spring... I mean, sorry, in the fall of 2007 to get a PhD. So I worked in,
and that's what you're getting now.
That's what I'm working on.
And these people are very happy for you.
Right. And in the spring of 2008, so I hadn't been gone for very long, found out there was a shooting at Northern Illinois University.
And that was that kid.
And it was him. It was the star student. It was the guy that I worked in the lab with for a year. In fact, the news reports... That night in the shooting, we didn't know the identity of the shooter. They said he was a sociology student who had left the previous year. What I didn't know is this kid left left that program.
He left when you left.
Yeah, he actually ended up leaving. Yeah, not long after I left, he got really dark, and people didn't hear from him. He transferred to some other school.
Uh-huh.
So they said the shooter was a sociology student, tall white male, thin, who left the previous year.
And it's you!
It was me and this other guy were the only two people that fit that description. So I was getting phone calls of people saying, oh, very happy you picked up the phone. And so we knew that.
Did you know Sean Gray at the time?
I did not know Sean Gray at the time.
Sean, that's a callback, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode. Because you're also a musician, you could be considered a guy that's dark simply because of the music you play and because of the way you dress.
For black clothes.
You wear black clothes every time I see you. And like the fact that you're wearing jeans now that aren't like super dark is very weird.
Yeah, gray. I'm
you're
especially
gray.
Colorful with my gray jeans.
But so you go from Northern Illinois to University of Maryland.
Right.
And you're getting your PhD in sociology, specifically social theory.
Right.
So
I came to Maryland to work with study under a theorist named George Ritzer, who wrote this book called The McDonaldization of Society.
So you came here for a specific dude?
Basically, yeah.
Do you know that man still?
Yes.
Are you happy?
I've worked with him since then.
Are you happy you chose him? Is this kind of like choosing a band, like what kind of band to be in? Like,
yeah, kind of.
Really? How did you start that research?
Well, The McDonaldization of Society is a very approachable book. It takes a lot of very difficult theory on rationalization of society and bureaucracy. These are classic sociology theories. And then George Ritzer took them and said how McDonald's, the fast food restaurant, is the best example of these processes of rationalization that go all throughout society. And I really liked the way it's very easy to understand, it's very catchy, and it goes beyond just people who get degrees in sociology.
See,
academia is very limiting. People talk in jargon, they talk to other academics, and I liked that he was speaking, he's taking these difficult theories and is able to make them very understandable and fun.
So you want to be accessible.
Correct. Yeah.
So you chose a guy that's already accessible. That makes sense. Right. What do you, right now, what's the reason why you were on Baltimore's radio was because of Google Plus.
Mm-hmm.
And what, so Google Plus is this, if you're listening to this, you know what this Google Plus is, but you're also kind of, like, today I've been following you on Twitter, and it was a lot about what's going on in the UK right now.
Yeah.
Can we talk about that for a little bit?
Yeah, let's talk about that. Can we put a period on, I don't think we haven't really made
forth.
The connection.
We're going to go everywhere, but continue.
I'm going to let you weave.
No, do your things. No, go. No, once you interrupt, you have to finish the thoughts.
I just wanted to put a connection between how I started with knowledge and very abstract sort of theoretical concepts and how we got to technology, how I'm now tweeting about UK riots on Twitter and talking about Google Plus on NPR. And so my master's thesis I had, it was about anti-intellectualism and populism was a real, George Bush, I think George W. Bush, I'm writing my master's thesis while he's president.
Yeah.
And you know, he's winning debates because he didn't sound as smart as the other people. Yeah, this really interested me. And one thing I wanted to look at was this sort of populism. You know, George W. Bush, everyday guy, straight shooter.
The guy you want to have a beer with.
Right, and Wikipedia struck me as a great example of populism as applied to knowledge.
Okay.
Where it's not an expert, but rather the masses of people that are getting to determine what makes it into this encyclopedia as opposed to Britannica.
But the difference between Britannica and Wikipedia is you don't have to pay to print Wikipedia.
Right.
So it's always updated.
So anybody can read it and anybody can write it.
And anybody could fix it. And what do you think the percentage of true fact is on Wikipedia?
It's very good. There's been studies that have compared it to Britannica. Now, you don't know where the errors are.
Absolutely.
Of course, you don't know where the errors are in Britannica either.
Exactly.
I mean, I can make a silly edit right now to Wikipedia. But
well, my favorite one.
By and large, it is.
If you listen to the show, you'll know that for a while, Junior Stopka, famous Chicago comedian with the famous Junior Stopka podcast on iTunes, was Rumpelstiltskin for a month or two on Wikipedia. So we know how to screw around with Wikipedia. But at the same time, Encyclopedia Britannica is written by experts, and no matter what, experts have bias.
Right.
So isn't this kind of like the great populist knowledge center?
Yeah, but that's not to say that the populace doesn't have a bias.
Absolutely,
and
you're
that's one interesting thing is, you know, what's the most popular food? McDonald's. Who was very good in populist elections? George W. Bush. What's the restaurant people like to shop in? Walmart. Very, you know, these are the sorts of. Some people say that
it's okay. It's so good. But you could also just say the reason being is that it has nothing to do with the food, has nothing to do with the politician, has nothing to do with the product, it has everything to do with the price.
You think the price for George W. Bush was cheaper than Al Gore or John Kerry?
Yeah, absolutely, because those guys were asking you to make sacrifices.
Kerry and Gore.
Yeah, right. And Bush didn't actually say that. They just kind of made you make a sacrifice.
So the thing that the bias of the populace might be, your argument then, would be cheapness. The cheaper things.
Exactly.
Populism, a populist enterprise, whatever it is, an election, food, knowledge, will tend towards or trend towards what's cheaper, more accessible.
Absolutely. Yeah. For the masses.
Yeah. And that's, I would absolutely agree with that.
Yeah.
So that's a bias of...
that's a populist bias.
Right, and I think that's the culture of Wikipedia doesn't like to acknowledge. They would say the will of the people, the greatest number of people, is inherently unbiased.
Do you think it'd be different if Britannica was completely free online and you could, like, access it the same way you could access Wikipedia? I'm not saying that it isn't now, but I just mean the ease of it.
Right.
Do you think it'd be just as popular?
Would Britannica be just as popular if you couldn't be? Yeah, I'm not even sure if we would have a Wikipedia if Britannica was that open to everybody. There's certain things that Britannica isn't going to touch. You're not going to see an incredibly detailed and complete listing of every single Muppets episode on Britannica.
Well,
but the crowd will come together and create
absolutely,
that.
Absolutely.
So you see complete and different languages. Wikipedia is in so many different languages. The breadth... is quite a bit different.
How much different is a certain entry based on language alone? I know it's not just a simple Babelfish translation or something. So, like, let's say I'm watching Doctor Who right now. I've never seen a more intricate series page on Wikipedia. Do you know if that's different in German, in French? Is it the same with Ben? Like, how much information differs from language to language?
I've heard studies that said that the German Wikipedia is filled with many more errors.
Really?
But I'm monolingual. I only speak one language, so I don't have any first-hand account or evidence of differences by language. But there is.
What about
some
UK US? Are there different pages for the UK version or the US version? I'm not saying like The Office, which has both, but I'm just saying you. Let's say you're on Wikipedia. Is there a UK version and US, or is it only by language?
Right. It's going to differ based on language.
So it's not by country.
I'm not absolutely positive on how that breaks down. I know it breaks down in language, and I know it's studies that break it down in language. I'm not sure if it breaks down in
language. Do you know the age breakdown for the common entry age?
Yeah, so there's been a lot of research on who edits Wikipedia.
Yeah.
So Wikipedia is created by actually typing into the, you know, click on edit on a page, and there's a box you can actually type knowledge. That's the easy work. The hard work is then editing that. There's massive debates. You can see the debate page behind every entry. And so there's a lot of debate, a lot of argument on what knowledge gets to make it, what edits are accepted. And so all of that work of writing and editing is done by very few people, it turns out. A very, very small number of actual Wikipedia users do any of this work. It's overwhelmingly young white males.
Okay.
Overwhelmingly. So Wikipedia
is in their field.
No. There's no original research on Wikipedia. Everything that you edit cannot be your own research. You can only link out to other research.
I get that, but
so
the people, the editors, they're not experts.
They're not experts.
So how do you prove something either way?
You have to cite to something. External research that you did not conduct, and then there's a group of people who will then say, you know, we'll have to create some sort of consensus.
What's preventing someone from writing their own page? Like, let's say I'm going to review the new Strokes record. So I write two different reviews, one with a pseudonym and one with a real name, and I use BYT and I use the City Paper, and I link both of them back to the Strokes page. And that, and let's say I want to skew it, let's say they're both negative actually, and I want to skew the reviews down even more, so can I just create my own pages outside of that and then source myself? You see what I mean? I know it's convoluted, but isn't... Thank you.
Our food is good.
Thank you so much.
Right, so you can write a review about the Strokes record, really negative review, and then you can link to that review on Wikipedia.
Yeah,
but you would say something on Wikipedia like the Strokes record has received some good press, but a whole lot more bad press, and then quote a review. Now, I'm not sure if the Wikipedia editors are going to like a BYT review. They're going to have something from Rolling Stone or from Pitchfork. Rolling Stone.
I understand.
Or Pitchfork.
Well, we'll stop for now. We'll come back to this because we haven't done anything with Britain, and I want to get into that.
All right.
Food.
Hey everybody, thanks for listening to the show. I really appreciate it. I'm butting in to let you know that I write a weekly column for this website called Brightest Young Things. The name of the column is called Behind the Desk, and it's pretty much whatever is applicable to this talk show or talk shows in general, things that I find fascinating. It goes up once a week at brightestyoungthings.com, and you can find every column at youmethemeverybody.com. So if you haven't been to the website in a while, that's an excuse to go. Once again, it's called Behind the Desk. It's a weekly column I write, and I'd really appreciate it if you gave it a glance. Thanks for listening, and back to the show.
Let's talk about what's going on right now in the UK.
Yeah.
We went to a ball game the other night, and it was like day two or three of this thing, and I wasn't exactly clear of what's going on. I don't think anyone's exactly clear with what's going on. But I do want to talk about the social media aspect of it. Cameron said that he was kind of like trying to blame social media at one point.
Right.
Which seems insane to me.
Yeah.
What should people know about this thing?
It's been pretty clear that social media has been used in the cleanup.
Okay.
Of London and the other cities that have been affected by these riots. It's been used for people to find out information on where the riots are, where the damage is taking place, on social support networks of people helping each other out. The big riot cleanup, mm-hmm. the hashtag riot cleanup, and there's a Twitter account, last I saw it was like 80,000 followers, riot cleanup. That's how social media has been used. So far, I've seen zero evidence that Facebook or Twitter has been used in organizing the riots. It doesn't seem like the rioters are self-organizing using Facebook and Twitter. This is an assumption because so much of the organization of
the
Arab Spring in Egypt, Tunisia, and other countries has been done on Facebook and Twitter. So I think people just assume. I have seen zero evidence that that's what occurred in the UK. Instead, it seemed like that the rioters were communicating mostly using BlackBerry Messenger, which is very popular in London.
Could you explain the difference between BlackBerry Messenger and Twitter and Facebook, etc.?
I think the most relevant difference is it's not public facing.
Exactly.
So Facebook and Twitter are public facing. I can go find evidence of what people are saying on Twitter. BlackBerry Messenger is more like text messaging. It's just people can text message with each other.
But you're text messaging a group, right?
Yeah, you have an avatar. You comes up with a picture of your face next to your text message. You can send videos and photos if you want as well. And you can geotag your message that is, pinpoint your location on a map. But there's no evidence. I haven't seen any evidence that people are were using BBM or BlackBerry Messenger to actually organize the riot. Say, hey, the police are here, let's go there, or something like that. And we may not find that information because, again, it's not public facing. It's mostly private information. I'm not sure.
Do you think they could change that, though?
Will BlackBerry change that?
Yeah, like change the policies behind that?
They might. So Cameron, it came out at immediately and said that they would look into maybe just shutting down social media in response.
Which I literally laughed at.
Unbelievable response, given that social media has been primarily used to respond to the riots. While he was vacationing in Italy for the first 2 days of these riots, the people that lived in London were figuring out how to deal with these riots. How to clean up the city, and that's what social media was being used for. And you have this guy that was vacationing coming back and saying, "Yeah, we should shut down social media." It's an unbelievable response, and ironically similar to what Mubarak in Egypt did when the riots, the protests, the revolt, the uprising occurred there. He shut down the internet, turned off the internet. Very similar.
But the difference between the two is that seemed to be a unified front against something.
Yeah.
Where
protest signs.
Yeah, like there's
slogans.
There's a reason to be doing this. Where the UK riots just seem not pointless. There's definitely a point, but it's not one point. It's 1,000 arrows with no seeming end. Like, how do you? You can't just lift up an entire class of people. So why? Why is this going on?
Well,
I'll answer this in a minute.
One of the one of Cameron's biggest mistakes. I don't think shut down social media was his biggest mistake. He started all this by saying, if to ask the question of why is to give reason, and to actually support the protesters. And you shouldn't even ask the question why, or else you're justifying
their, exactly. It's their the whole we don't negotiate with terrorists idea. It's insane.
Right, and so there's a lot of people. I think people are just saying, "Oh, they're just criminals. They're just thugs," and then not asking why people turn to crime, not asking why people are looting stores is offensive, and there's many reasons. But even for the people that were rioting that would say they're not even rioting because they dislike the government. They're not even rioting because they feel like they've been treated unfairly. Like,
or the police brutality.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely people rioting that had those very explicit political reasons. But even if there was plenty of people that were rioting for no political reason, I would want to know
why.
Yeah. Why? What politically about that country is making it so that people feel so... that they're willing to just destroy a society? Why do they feel that disconnected from society? There's you have to ask that question.
I feel like I'm in the twilight of my years of understanding why for a lot of these people. Like I think I get it, and that's because I'm 28, and I don't know if I'll understand it at 38. So I've been working on this monologue for tonight. Nathan is also the drummer on the live show. Nothing to do with this, but. That's why I like having him around. We could talk about this type of stuff. So I've been working on my monologue for the past 2 days, and I have a lot of notes, but I can't find the funny in here. Okay? So the reason why tonight is all about social media, and the reason why I want to talk about this topic specifically is that our first guest is Kale from British Young Things. It's a website which you shoot photos for and I write for. It's like the website for DC pop culture. Or underground culture, whatever you want to call
the
it.
The hipster scene.
It's the hipster scene.
And what does this person do for BYG?
He does all the events. So Svetlana essentially runs the sites, and he runs all
the
events.
The calendar
he
guy.
Is the party guy. And the whole point of my monologue tonight will be that we are the first generation that is documenting every aspect of it. This is the first generation where if you want... you could easily shoot a photo of yourself every day over 10 years and just live that way.
And people will see it.
Exactly.
People could have done that a long time ago, but now you have an audience.
You couldn't even do that 50 years ago. You couldn't afford the film unless you were crazy rich. And it's true. And 100 years ago, you had to sit for an hour or two. So no, you couldn't just do this long ago.
Let's go with this for a second. Right now, at this table, we're sitting at a table, and we're documenting our talk.
Absolutely.
I can pull out my phone, take a photo of Brandon, send that to Facebook. I'll tag Brandon's name on that, and maybe I'll even geotag the photo. So now I have a documentation. I'm with Brandon, that I'm at this restaurant, and where the restaurant is. I can also quickly write a review on Yelp. I can and then tweet a status update. I'm recording. I could tweet something saying I'm recording a podcast with Brandon at this restaurant, and then I can check into the restaurant on Foursquare. I can do all of these things from my phone in probably 2 minutes.
Yes, easily.
So
it's new.
Yeah,
it's so new.
That's me agreeing with your premise.
That's my first note. We've been given the gift and the curse of full-time documentation. Our children will be forever bored by us. We will be forever bored by them. There is nothing new for us. Not that there was anything new for our parents or their parents or the parents before them, but it appeared that way. We were the first generation to party. No. You're not the first to do anything now. And now it is lost. And that's not necessarily a bad thing or a good thing. That's just something we have to accept. And then I want to figure out how to tie in the UK riots and social media and all this stuff to it. So, like, I have the UK riots can't be blamed on Facebook. It's not really revolution. It's kind of the opposite of revolution. It's the lack of a unified anything, a unified stance or belief. Or a team, even, that makes this much more confusing than ever before.
It's chaos for chaos' sake. If there's any unification, it's chaos. Breaking down the rules of everyday society.
But it's not like some weird fight club where two privileged, like, let's fight the society model. It's like, no, we're the opposite. We're at the bottom scale of it. There's only a fight club and successive fight club because there's the middle class and the upper class.
I mean, maybe it's more amazing that these riots don't occur every day. That every day we're all working together on making society work, and we don't have to. There's a social theorist by the name of Irving Goffman, and he said that we're gentle giants.
Okay.
That we're giants because any one of us can cause a great. We can radically change everybody's lives in a moment if we want to. Think of the shooter at Northern Illinois University.
Yeah.
All he had to do was just decide to do that, and he radically changed many people's lives, ended people's lives.
But can you do it in a positive way?
And you can do it in a positive
How?
Way. But that's much more difficult. Very difficult to it takes a long time. But so we can completely upset the rules of social order. Like think of Tom Green or Jackass guys that get out and change the rules of everyday lives, which is funny.
Yeah.
But we all could do that anytime. We could do that right now. But he says we're gentle giants because we don't. And that's.
It's having the gun and choosing not to use it.
Yeah, right. When you drive down the highway, like every car that passed you, you should be thanking them that they didn't murder you. If they wanted to, every single car that passed you on that two-lane road could murder you.
That is kind of true.
And
you only get murdered once.
Every single
though, so.
One, with very rare exceptions, doesn't.
Yeah.
So maybe it's. But why is that? I think that's the more interesting question. Why isn't there a riot every day? Why do we maintain social order? And
so
now
we don't
we have,
die.
Right. We don't want to live in the state of the Hobbesian, the state of nature. But when it becomes more advantageous to break down the society, the normal operation of society, because the normal operation of society isn't benefiting you, it's screwing you over.
Is this beneficial, though? Are these riots beneficial?
I think that's the wrong question. I don't think that really matters at this point. In the long run, I think that is an interesting question, and we should talk about if these riots will bring
anything.
A more good, more bad, will be a wash.
I kind of feel like the longer they go on, the more potential they have to be a force of good.
Some people see it as a very interesting critique on neoliberal economics.
Yeah.
The massive cuts in social programs that the UK has enacted and what the United States is looking to enact.
What is it, like 40% unemployment rate for their young adults, and we have like 20 or something like that?
Yeah, I mean, the youth unemployment is usually about double adult unemployment, but it's very high.
Yeah.
And in fact, some of the parallels are very close. There's massive inequality between the rich and the poor in both the United States and the UK. Both are enacting what they call austerity programs, which are cutting back on government spending, retracting the size of government. So you basically have a global recession affecting both countries, massive inequalities, and then what do? They cut social programs when they're being leaned on more than ever. And so they're leaning on those social programs. You cut them, they're going to fall. And it might be that maintaining the operation of everyday society is no longer advantageous for a lot of these people.
Well, I have this, so I can go along with this and be right. And the riots are scary because it's not just individuals writing angry Yelp reviews, it's poor people lashing out. Is that fair to say or no?
Yeah, I don't know if we have a cross-section on the income of the actual rioters. We know where the riots took place, and they took place in poor areas in London. And we know that the rioters were ethnically very diverse.
Mm-hmm.
Some people immediately came out and said that their black folks were rioting
and
tried to make it a racial issue. White folks, black folks, Asians, people from all over the globe were...
But make it clear, poor neighborhoods.
In poor neighborhoods. And
it's highly unlikely... people in nice condos are heading down to the poor neighborhoods and rioting. That just doesn't make sense.
Right. And when you look at the stores that were being looted, they weren't looting the highest end stores.
No.
They were looting the stores that they would likely shop at.
Yeah.
And I think that says something about the economic and the class and the consumerist side of these.
I just think it's a bunch of people that aren't happy, that probably hate their surroundings and hate themselves due to it and have nothing to aspire to.
I don't think we can say whether they hate themselves.
I hate their position in life.
Yeah, or maybe even worse,
that's
they're indifferent.
I mean. Yeah, that's fair. I have
you hate something, you try to change it. This wasn't a protest with picket signs trying to change the austerity programs, saying we need to bump raise the minimum wage.
Well, you did didn't you tell me earlier this week that's kind of what they were doing a few months ago, and no one was paying attention, and now they are.
Yeah, there was a great interview with a protester. I think it was on MSNBC.com. I think it was basically one of the protesters said, "Hey, we were marching peacefully a couple months ago, and there wasn't any cameras. There's nobody wanted to cover it. This is, you know, there was obviously a police shooting of a black man in London, and police. There's very few police shootings in London. This isn't the United States where everybody's carrying guns. This is very, you know, in fact, when you look at it, there was no gun deaths in these riots. I think the LA riots had like 50 something gun deaths because we carry guns here. They don't carry guns here. So there's a police shooting, which is very, and it was handled inappropriately. And there was a lot of protests, again, peaceful protests around that. And eventually, when media isn't going to cover it, when there aren't cameras, burning a couple cop cars on that first night, which is what ignited everything, that got people's attention. And so this protester was saying, hey, we were marching peacefully. There wasn't any cameras. Now look around you. And sure enough, there was news cameras everywhere.
I also have in here, this is where it goes back to Kale. Non-traditional gatherings with non-traditional people are still exciting. It's one of the things that isn't lost due to social media or due to whatever. No matter how you do it, the party can still be exciting.
Absolutely.
The riot is always going to be exciting.
I heard one news channel call the riots a flash mob.
That's great.
It's just, you know,
they all planked and left.
Right, exactly. But I think you're touching on absolutely, you know, for me, it has to do with my dissertation, all of my research, the fundamental point about social media is it's not opposed to gatherings in physical space.
No.
There's some people, or actually they think it's interesting that social media would bring people to get together in physical space, because isn't Facebook that thing that you do instead of talking to people face to face? Isn't that thing you do in your darkened bedroom and having some fake version of a social life, and, you know, like Mark Zuckerberg at the end of the Social Network movie? You know, isn't that what social media is? No, that's what social media is to old guys writing movie Social Network who don't use Facebook. Anybody who uses social media knows that it has everything to do with the physical world.
Yeah.
It brings people together in physical space. That's how flash mobs are organized. That's how the protests in Egypt were organized. I would agree with that. And BYT is doing the same thing, using the web to bring people together in physical space. That's not surprising.
Here's where I go too big that I can't get back from, and there's no funny. It's that the first world is crumbling, but that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's an inevitable shift that you can't really control. Or am I insane? Am I insane for thinking this?
No. Oh, I mean, look at you have, you know, horrible greed and looting.
But you've had this forever. It's just that everything now is kind of in the open.
It's, I mean, the amount of greed and looting done on Wall Street. And the markets crashing. It doesn't seem like we're really able to recover. It doesn't really seem like I don't think we're going to get back to where we were in the early aughts.
No.
I don't think the market. We're living in a new time when in the global economy, we're with China and Brazil and a lot of other countries are now players. I mean, that's why we could run those massive debts in Reagan in his time. You know, so debt spending, that's Reaganomics. That's what Reaganomics is massive debts, because who cares? Is China's not going to call on your debt.
Yeah.
You know, we're the only superpower, us and Russia, and then just us. And today that's not really the case. Brazil's economy, China's economy, these are India's economy, these are massive economies that we rely on, and you know, we're not that important.
But
we're not as important as we used to.
We're also not the only ones just like floundering too. I mean, what about Greece? What about Italy?
The West.
Yeah, we're evening out, it seems.
We're absolutely evening out. And we've been living beyond our means.
Yeah.
The West has been living very wealthy lives. Some of us, not all of us, in the West have been living very wealthy lives that we didn't deserve. We weren't producing anything. We were just doing it on debt. Governments in debt.
Don't you wish, though, that you kind of got a house out of this deal? Like, come on, man. Shouldn't we I'd love to just trade in an awful credit rating for a house at this point. Like, where was I 5 years ago?
Yeah,
we're hitting
the economy after.
Yeah, this sucks.
I think you're right. The economic and political and military primacy of the West. I mean, we can't win wars anymore. It used to be that was the whole idea. We could run deficit economies because we could win any war we needed to win. We can't win wars anymore. It's a mess. And I think we're getting enough news economically with riots. The West is not in the same position that it used to be. That's globalization.
I also have what we're losing is the context. So we're going to have these party pictures. We're going to have the riot pictures. But are we even going to remember where we were at the party? Are we even going to remember why we're rioting? We're losing a sense of history. We're not learning anything anymore.
Oh, I disagree with that. I think somebody taking a photo in Tahrir Square, T-A-H-R-I-R Square in Egypt.
T-squared.
I think somebody taking a photo of them at the revolution and the uprisings, posting it to Facebook. You know, I'm not sure if any context is lost in that.
So I should get rid of that then.
I think there are examples, but I think there are counterexamples as well. I don't think it's necessarily a trend of social media
that we're losing context.
That we've lost all. If anything, we have an abundance of context.
It just seems like think about like your parents, like or their parents. Like, where did they have photos of? Maybe a graduation, a wedding for sure. Maybe a birth. Maybe a confirmation. And that's it. It wasn't like this was Tuesday the 4th. This was Wednesday the 5th. And we can do that now.
Right. Yeah, I think the wedding photo will still be
the wedding photo.
You're right that because the limits, the barriers to taking a photograph have massively reduced that. Now that you have a good phone in your pocket at all times, if you're one of the majority of young people that have smartphones, you can take a photo anytime you want, and there's no film, you just publish it immediately. Yeah. And the barriers of taking a photo have lost, so we're taking many more photos of many more mundane things.
But we're also taking away the nostalgia of photos. It's no longer a big deal to go to the Walgreens and pick up your photos and then keep them and show them to your friends. Like, right. And that's kind of a good thing. We can't live in the past as much.
Well, but we found a way around that.
What is that?
The Hipstamatic, the Instagram, the faux vintage sort of filters that we place on photos vintage. To try to reclaim
it's not about the look.
Nostalgic.
It's about the process, to me.
Yeah, but why do people enjoy consuming that on other people's Tumblr feeds and their Twitter feeds and their,
it looks
and their
cool.
Facebook streams?
Because it looks cool, but the process the is image. Still lost. What they hold dear to them, what is actually nostalgic, is completely lost now. And I think that the fashion trends are trending. That's an awful phrase. Where we're just meeting itself. We're already at the 90s, and it's only 2011.
I think the Onion had an article.
We're
once,
going to eat itself. It's a right, snake
where,
tail.
Where that the nostalgia in the Onion, the nostalgia was going to actually catch up to present.
We're
and then,
doing
then the
that.
World ends.
Yeah,
in that moment.
That's where we're at. I think we're like 4 years away from people just wearing plain clothes.
No, I agree. There's a philosopher of postmodernity named Frederick Jameson. He had this great phrase called nostalgia for the present.
Yeah,
and I find it endlessly useful to think of the ways in which that we try to be nostalgic for our present. That is, viewing our present as already a past. And I think that's what the Instagram filters, most of the Instagram filters.
You wrote a great
does.
Piece about this that people could find.
Yeah, I wrote a piece on my blog, Cyborgology. So Cyborgology. And it is called the Faux Vintage Photo. And I talk a bit about nostalgia for the present. As sort of a search for authenticity. I think we're in an authenticity crisis right now. And so I wrote a longer piece on this, an essay on this, and it got reported in the NPR and the Boston Globe, and it really blew up. One of my favorite authors, William Gibson,
you had a conversation with him.
He just keep quoted it, and just like a back and forth on Twitter, which was really cool. He like wrote Neuromancer and coined the word cyberspace and things like that. And so,
you are
so
a nerd.
It really took off. It seems like there's a lot of people that do want to think about what these hipstamatic photos, even war photos. We saw these photos coming from Afghanistan, where we want the war in Afghanistan to kind of look a lot like Vietnam and World War II.
I understand both of those things. I understand World War II, obviously, because we won, but not the Vietnam thing. That's a little weird. I want to tie that into the daily deals. One of the only things I do every single day is check the Living Social, check the Groupon, check the Scout Mob and all that stuff, and how sad that is. Because I have this wonderful technology and I'm trying to just save $5 on Pad Thai because I can't afford not to because I'm so broke, yet I have this phone that costs a lot of money. See what I mean? Like, it's once again...
Right,
so
you have a smartphone and you're eating out.
Yeah, exactly. Well, no, I barely eat out, but the only time I do... is when I have one of these things.
Then I think the Asian equivalent of a fajita is happening.
Yes. What is that? I don't know what that
is. I don't
is.
Know. But it looks great, and it's sizzling. It's got the attention of the entire restaurant. It's done just what a fajita's done.
It's perfect.
What were you talking about? Oh, right. So, retrieval problems.
Yeah. Fuck you. I have it. This will be the transition between probably Kale and the social media. And it's, I used to read a lot more books. I used to watch a lot more films before I had a smartphone.
Yeah, so you're using your smartphone wrong.
I'm not. It's not the phone's fault. It's completely my fault. Exactly. It's no different than like a college freshman that's going to like every kegger. It's not like it's just something to do. You're using it, but you're using it maybe too much, maybe not enough. But you just can't.
Yeah.
I don't want to think anymore. I want to. I always want to be working, and this is the best thing to always want to be working. It's absolutely the worst thing to like think.
Unless thinking is your job.
Is it my job? I don't know.
Comedian.
I'm not a comedian. I'm a host. But it's different because I feel like I'm not actually losing anything. And the amount of information I'm obtaining is, I'd say, on par, if not greater, than where it was 5 years ago because of this goddamn phone. So is it worth
it? So why is your phone keeping you from reading?
Oh, because I'm on Twitter. Anytime I would be, I used to read every morning to and from work when I would take the bus to work.
You'd read like a magazine,
no,
a novel,
book. It'd always, it'd be fiction, not, book, just a book. It doesn't matter, a book. So I'd be 20 minutes there, 20 minutes back. But then when I know I'm going to be going home, I'll just load up like 4 hours of tweets, and that's my 20 minutes. And I'll read articles based on that. Like today I read an article that Dave Zirin, a sports writer for The Nation, about why stadiums are actually bad for cities and stuff like that. And tax incentive is how it never actually pays off, and there hasn't been one example in the past 25 years. That was a fantastic article, and I wouldn't have read that or would have known about it if it wasn't for this. I might have, maybe 5 years ago, I would have read it in an anthology for the best sports
writer. So you've decided that on your commute, a better form of communication, what you want to read are either short sound bites via Twitter, or you want to read an article.
Or news.
You'd
yeah.
rather read that than a novel on the train.
Absolutely, yeah. And I feel like that's not necessarily a good thing. I remember working in an office and then printing out Steve Albini's very long piece about the music industry, you know, the whole I'm going to swim across the pool shit. That whole thing. I would. How is that much different?
Right, well, maybe there was, maybe it was, were you able to give your full attention to the book on your way to work? Because it sounds like your brain is asking for easier to digest, simpler communication on your, because, I can't concentrate when I'm in a train.
No, it's the first minute, minute's hard, and when you're getting off, the last few stops are hard. Same with the bus. But if it's a long commute, like a mega bus to New York, I'll read. I'll still read.
Yeah. On an airplane, is. I find that I choose what I'm going to read based on where I'm going to be. If I'm going to be at my favorite coffee shop with a cup of coffee on a couch, that's when I'm going to bust out some heavy theory, and I know I'm going to be able to give some pretty deep conversation concentration. If I'm going to be in a train for 20 minutes, I'm going to find something fun to read.
Okay.
And so may not even be the issue. Might have was actually trying to read the more difficult.
So it has
text.
Nothing to do with the phone, you think?
Clearly the phone gives you new opportunities.
But all it's doing is presenting another opportunity. It's not. Well, I'm never saying it. I shouldn't have said the phone's fault. That's the whole point. It's not the phone's fault.
Right. Yeah, correct. I mean, you're...
It's the tool. You're using the tools correctly.
Yeah, and so if, you know, if you feel like you're missing out on reading a book, then, you know, read a book some other time. You know, it's like people tell me, oh, Twitter's so dumb. It's just a bunch of people tweeting about what they had
for
breakfast.
Then don't follow them.
It's like, yeah, well, don't you're following the wrong. You're using it wrong.
I unfollow people almost
daily. You don't say the radio's broken because all you hear is Katy Perry. You just got to tune it to the wrong channel. You've got it on the wrong channel.
You really hate Katy Perry, man. Like, it's like the fifth Katy Perry reference in 4 days with you. Why do you not like Katy Perry? Her husband wrote a fantastic article today for The Guardian.
I did. I read it. I thought it was very smart. Russell Brand did that. I thought it was pretty smart. And he wrote a really eloquent piece after Amy Winehouse died as well.
Did you ever listen to his radio show?
No, I didn't. I just watched an interview with one of it was a UK. It was an interview. I don't know who it was for. Some big show in the UK. And he was very...
Recent?
Very recent. Okay. Very recent. I guess he was responding to some prank call that he left on some elderly person's answering machine.
Oh, this was that got him kicked off the radio.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
The guy that played like
when was that?
2009, 2008.
So the interview is at least since 2000.
He's brilliant. I honestly
believe he seems like a smart guy.
They just haven't found the right market.
So he's engaged to this Katy Perry thing.
They're married.
They're married.
They're
now.
Married.
Okay, he was engaged during this interview. So that's as much as I knew. No, she just seems. To me is kind of like a easy target in that she's so fake so much completely a character rather than like a person.
That's fine.
In the way that she presents herself or is presented by others. So she's, to me, you know, but there's always, every year there'll be somebody different.
I'd rather
have Ashley Simpson.
I'd rather have her than Liz Phair, though. I'd rather have someone just accepting the fakeness rather than pretending to be poor. Like, that bothers me even more.
Yeah, I mean, that's the biggest underlying logic and everything that we talk about with, you know, contemporary society is self-awareness.
Yeah.
That's what our generation wants above everything is self-awareness.
I think she is self-aware.
And she's self-aware. She says, I'm a pop star,
yeah,
and I'm going to present myself as a pop star.
I'm going to wear pink hair and have lollipops as a bra.
Right, because we will not accept somebody who pretends to be a real artist as a pop star. We're going to see through that, and we're going to say that's a sham.
Thank you. Are you being sarcastic right now? Because
People
disagree completely.
What's the counterexample?
Justin Timberlake
was very self-aware that I'm a, you know, he made jokes about being a pop star when he was a pop star. You know, now he's more of a comedian than he is.
But he's not funny, and he's not, I don't get it.
And he was popular. I mean, NSYNC was popular before the sort of cultural moment that I'm talking about, before really everybody was online,
yeah,
social media. You know, he sort of came around right at the height,
mm-hmm,
of, or at the end of, I would say, like the last cultural moment.
But he got to transition seamlessly between pop star to respectable musician with his first album, and like got to play the Grammys and was nominated for shit. That's not real. Like, that's completely fake. Why is that given a pass?
Yeah, I mean, I'll concede.
And
that.
I shouldn't say that the Grammys are like the beacon. I mean,
right,
the Grammys were created so a bunch of white guys don't let rock and roll in the door. Like,
right. I can only give that a pass to the extent that people our age think that the Grammys are still a relevant component of pop culture. And increasingly, I don't think that's true.
Absolutely.
I don't think people our age are looking to the Grammys for, you know, relevance anymore.
So this will be tonight's monologue. It'll be an hour discussion between Nathan and I, and then we'll have guests on. It'll be fantastic. I'll make them play drums in between.
I'm involved in the monologue.
Well, here's the thing. So I got, these are the four points I want to hit, right? Kale.
I thought that's a cake.
Cake.
Because I was ready to talk
band
about cake.
They're okay. Kale from BYT, UK riots, social media, and daily deals. I have one line that I know will get a laugh. It's not a closer, and I have no idea how to tie these together, and I've been working on this for the past few days. And hopefully by the time you either come to the show or listen to the next show, I will have something that's worthwhile. If not, oh well. Nathan, where can people find you online?
Well, I have a website. It's just my name, Nathan Jurgensen, NathanJurgensen.com. I blog for a blog called, that I started, called Cyborgology, CYBORGOLOGY. If you just Google that, you'll find it.
And we'll link all that stuff to the actual podcast. You are a drummer. You play around town. What's your next show? Do you have a next show?
I don't know what my next show is. I'm involved in a couple of projects, a couple of brand new projects that I don't want to talk about yet, but we'll soon see the light of day.
I love when you're interviewing someone and they go, I don't want to talk about, you know, the thing that you just brought up that I didn't know about until you just said you don't want to talk about it.
Well, I'm just trying to explain why I don't have many shows coming up. I've been gigging pretty much nonstop since I moved to DC.
You finished recording, because you did.
Well, yeah, so I also play with Aaron Thompson, and so we just recorded a record, and I'm sure we have some shows coming up.
See, there you go. Just come and go there. That's it. Come to the show tonight, everybody. Thanks for listening. Have a wonderful night.
Thanks, Brandon.
You need to say that.